get that then.
Okay. Well, it looks like we are going to see some sunshine after all this week. Do the sun command, I just need to set a couple of things here. Sorry, the sun just changes things too much.
We could quit.
No, 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 I want to hear the rest of this story. Can't quit now. Okay, and let's get your microphone. Oh, you already got it on? Okay, we're good to go.
Okay, we're back from our break, and just to recap briefly, you've taken us through the first couple of years of your service here as administrative director, and in those years you basically told us that you established your relationship with the court, you got the confidence of the court, and got the court to be confident in you and in your ability to really administer the court system by succeeding with the legislature, by showing that you really could perform. You got basically established a good working relationship with the legislature and won a good victory there. You established to the Bar Association that you really were the administrative director, and that the bar would have to work through you. And administratively, you were turning your attention to getting the executive branch to recognize the courts as a separate branch of government, and not just as an executive agency. And at the same time, administratively, you were trying to winnow down the functions of the court system to be judicial functions and trying to tackle that as a project.
Yes, I one thing is about budgets where legislators were unhappy were the uncontrollable areas. For example, when we had to appoint counsel in conflict cases when the public defender already represented a co-defendant. As earlier when I said we got rid of land records, you didn't know how many land records were going to be filed in any year, so you might have to come in for big increases for personnel or for equipment and so on and so forth. So I felt that we should get rid of these uncontrollables that were not necessarily tied directly to the judicial function, so we could be looked at as a judiciary. And the court was starting to think of itself. I mean, they always thought of themselves, the judges, as a separate branch of government, but they never, at least in my view, I don't think they'd ever considered the fact that they were being treated administratively like an agency. And so they were starting to, more than starting, they were coming to the point where they knew we were a third co-equal branch of government, and they had to wear two hats, one a judicial hat and the other one an administrative hat. And I was working with the trial judges, and I had to try to help get more judges on the court because they felt they were understaffed, and get better facilities. By now, we're in the last year Justice Buchheever's term, and he comes and he says that he would like to invite the Conference of Chief Justices and State Court Administrators to come to Alaska. And would that be okay? And I said, it will be a lot of work, but of course we would do that if that's what he wanted to do. And so I had to put my staff on that for almost a year to plan for that conference, plus all the other functions. We had to increase magistrate training. I really felt that many of the magistrates who were still working off their kitchen tables were probably unprepared for the job that they had. And Justice Rabinowitz, who was now coming back in for his second term, felt that, and he told me that one of his goals was to get all the magistrates out of their kitchens and all into offices. So that meant that was one of my new goals. So I had to start dealing with the federal government and, through LEAA for monies, and through the state for leased money. We had to beef up our magistrate training abilities. We along with people on my staff, created training judges for magistrates to work with them, so that judges that the magistrates could call if they had questions. We created a presiding judges committee where all the presiding judges would meet with me. And we, in turn, if there was an issue that they had, that we would meet with the Supreme Court on some of those issues as a group. I, along with the Attorney General, the Public Defender, the Commissioner of Corrections, the Commissioner of Public Safety, the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, created a criminal justice working group where we met every 6 weeks and had a staff prepare an agenda so we could sit down and resolve our problems instead of being so insular. It was through this that we would go back to the legislature and come up with some joint priorities and explain to the legislature that they had to fund the entire justice system, not just certain components, because the legislature did not like to fund the public defender, for example. I often had to go to my favorite legislators and ask them to increase the public defender's budget because it impacted this institution if we didn't have representation. But I also noted what was out of control were, because there were a few public defenders and there were multiple defendants, was the representation costs that were being paid by the court system. And at first I tried to control them through contracts with law firms. A law firm would get a contract for Anchorage, a law firm would get a contract for rural Alaska or the Kenai Peninsula. But I didn't feel that they were controlling their costs very well. And so I asked my staff, and by the way, my motto on staff, well, it's not a motto, that's the way I hired staff, is I would never hire anybody knowingly that didn't know more than me. Because why would I want a personnel director that knew less about personnel than I did? So I tried to hire the brightest people I could in their areas, and I made it clear to them that they were basically here to advise me. I just was providing direction, general direction for the institution. It was their job to be my advisors, not my job to hold their hand. And so I hired very bright, independent people who I thought, for the most part, were able to do that, and I gave them sometime tasks outside of their areas because I wanted to see how flexible and how broad their ability was. And one of the jobs I gave to a staff member was to find me a model for a public agency that can take over public defender conflicts. And they found in a county in California an Office of Public Advocacy that did some of these things, and I had them go over the statute and the local ordinance, I don't even think it was a statute, broaden it, make turn it into a bill. I went to the Supreme Court and I said, I want to get rid of appointing conflict attorneys because we can't control the costs, and the legislature yells every year, and the Supreme Court said okay.
And at this point, every individual judge just had the authority to to a point.
They did at first, but then when I did the contracts, they had to go with the contract agencies. At first, they did, and people were saying they were appointing their friends, and they probably weren't. It had an appearance problem. So that's why we went to the contract agencies. And the judges didn't really have a problem with that, as long as they could get a lawyer in there to get some representation and get these cases moving. So I submitted a bill to create an Office of Public Advocacy. And the executive branch, because it had a lot of money, and it seemed like everybody wants to have power, they didn't understand why I wanted to be getting rid of power all the time. And my real answer is that they're not going to be able to control the costs any more than I am, and let them go fight with the legislature for this. And the legislature passed the bill, and now the executive branch had to take care of all the conflicts, and we didn't have to worry about that anymore. Later on in my tenure, I also did the same thing with the coroner work. I spearheaded the creation of a medical examiner's office in the executive branch because all our magistrates were coroners, and they weren't equipped to be coroners. I mean, they don't know how a lot of people died. They weren't professionals. And our magistrates were worried about that. They didn't want to give up that function because they thought they'd take pay cuts because they'd have less responsibility. And I told them that we would not diminish their pay for that. We might diminish it if their caseloads went down or something like that, because we did have a way of we compensated magistrates by the level of workload they had. In any event, I started the project that the Chief Justice asked me to start, of getting all the magistrates off their kitchen tables and into offices. And we accomplished that within his 3 years, and we also accomplished bringing up in all the Chief Justices, and had a wonderful conference, and the rest of the world looked at the state like it was a perfect place, because we had merit selection, judiciary took care of its own budget, we built our own buildings, we had the Chief Justice from England came to that meeting. It was just a fine meeting.
Well, so what year was that?
That was about 80, I think. I'm not sure, 80, 81.
By this point, I'm curious about one thing. You described your first year with the legislature as just kind of stumbling into success with the legislature. But you obviously, as you went on and got the legislature year after year to continue to be helpful to the courts instead of being negative, you obviously had some key to ongoing success. What do you attribute that to? It's not all luck. I
mean, no.
What were the important things?
I learned. I mean, I had the ability to grow and learn and start to figure out how legislature works. That was one thing. Second,
so what was the key? What was it?
Relationships. You give your word to them, you testify to them, you tell them what the effect of a bill is going to be that you want introduced, so they never, it never comes back to bite them. Complete honesty, complete transparency, and whether they like you or not, that's what it comes down to. And they did like me. I wasn't deemed to be part of the political process. They were fighting governors, and they were fighting each other, the House and the Senate, and these earlier years were the years of what they call the ad hoc Democrats. There are liberal Democrats who like social services and who like courts, and so the House really protected us against Senator Sackett and Senator Ray, who weren't very happy with me. And although Senator Sackett and Senator Ray and others had stopped yelling about us putting in our budget directly, that they were starting to get used to that. What would happen is the House would pass a big budget for the court, adequate budget for the court, and a crummy budget for the university. The Senate would pass a good budget for the university because the Senate Finance Chair was generally out of the Fairbanks, and because they didn't like the courts or me, they'd cut our budget to shreds. And they'd go to conference committee. And what ended up happening is my budget got traded for the university's budget and conference committee, and so I always got my budget. And we never took a cut in our budget in the 24 and a half years I was here. But I also learned that you just don't talk to the liberal Democrats. You have to talk to the Republicans. You have to talk to everybody and treat everybody with respect. By then, Representative Ferguson had become Senator Ferguson, and he liked me, and he was an Eskimo. And Chancey Cross liked me, and he was a friend of Senator Sackett's. And Senator Sackett became chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And this was a major problem for me. So I thought it was time that I went to see Senator Sackett. And I went up and made an appointment to see the senator. And
he was your first enemy in the legislature.
My main enemy. And the reason I found out later that he had said that to the Finance Committee and created all that trouble because I had opposed the bill that he wanted for simultaneous translation of Yupik in rural Alaska, which is impossible. That Yupik wasn't even written everywhere. And it couldn't be done. So he was mad because I had opposed that bill, I found out. But in any event, I went up, made an appointment to see him. And his secretary liked me, and she said, rolled her eyes and said, okay, I'll make an appointment. And I showed up for the appointment. He didn't. Made another appointment, went back. I showed up. He didn't. Made a third appointment, told his secretary, if he misses this one, I guess we're not going to have an appointment because three strikes is still three strikes. And he showed up for that appointment. And I walked into his office and I sat down. And Clem Tillion had told him I'm a great guy. And Chancey Croft had told him I was a great guy and so on and so forth. And I went through a list. I said, these are the things you've done to me over the last number of years. You've killed this, you've delayed this, you did this, you did this. And this is what I've done to you. I killed that bill of yours. I did this, I did this, I did this. There's no way that any of that can be undone. But please don't take it out on the judiciary. Your people need the judges. Everyone needs the judges. The judiciary has to be that impartial third branch of government that's not politicized. Take things out on me personally, but please don't take it out on the judiciary. And he looked at me and he said, you should have come to me and said that years ago. We'll start afresh from here. And that was the end of the conversation. We became very good friends after that. And after a while, the House became more anti-court. It was a sort of populist thing. And the Senate protected my budget. Senator Sackett and Senator Ferguson and some of those others protected my budget. So it's just how the legislature works. I just learned how to work with the legislature, and I was good at it. I didn't like it. The reason I didn't like it is that if we did take any cuts in our budget, we can't fire judges, and that's where most of the salary money goes, and they're very highly paid, so we would have had to lay off a large number of lower salaried employees, like range 8s and 10s, which are sometimes single moms with kids just scraping by that need their jobs very much. And I was always so worried about that, about the employees, that if I failed, that's what would happen. And that was always in the back of my mind. So failure was not an option as far as I was concerned. In later years, I came up with a different strategy. I told them that if they cut our budget, because they said they want 10%, you know, that we'd go through all these exercises when they were cutting the budgets. And they were going to cut across the board 10%, and what would I cut? And I'd ask all the judges at first, and they'd say, we can't, and they'd wring their hands, and we can't do this, we don't have that kind of extra money, and so on and so forth. And we always seemed to escape it, and one year I finally figured out, I just said, that they said, what would you do if we cut 10% of your budget? I said, I'd cut courthouses. I'd close them. Because I don't want every courthouse not being able to operate. At least I want the ones that can operate to operate efficiently. So I would close courthouses. And they said, which ones? And I said, I won't tell you that, because if I did tell you that, that would be like threatening a legislator that I was going to close his courthouse. So I won't tell you which ones I would close. Doing that, I threatened all 60 of them because they didn't know which ones I would close. So that seemed to work very well. And I really never had any major problems of them cutting my budget. I did have a number of years when money was running out, with not being able to get pay raises and so on and so forth. But then I was able to get a big pay raise to catch up and that type of thing. So judges were alternatively happy and not happy, depending on how we fared in the pay area.
What part of your effort every year was devoted to the legislature, to the legislative session?
I would go down in the first month, maybe one day a week. In the beginning, remember, the legislatures did not have any finite time limit on it. As the session wore on and bills started to move and things started to happen, I'd get down more and more often. I did not return home more than a day during the last month and a half of the legislature. I lived in Juneau. Because the legislature went so long and they needed something, some reason to hold a party, on my birthday every year there was a party at Senator Sackett's house for me, and the invitation said, we don't really care about him, it's just an excuse to hold a party, so everybody come over. And Jay and Bella would come over and she'd bring food that she made, and other people would bring food, and lobbyists would bring liquor, and there'd be a huge party at Senator Sackett's house in my honor every year. But really, I was just an excuse for a party, and so that was fun. And when they went to a 120-day session, and we had some certainty, except for all the special sessions, I would rent either a suite at the Captain Cook or a house down there for the session, and just leave stuff there. It just got too burdensome to carry. The Baranoff, yes, I'm sorry. I just leave my stuff there. It was too burdensome bringing it back and forth. I knew the last month and a half of the session, I had to be there. There was no way I could leave. That's when all the final budget decisions were made. And things would happen like this. They're closing out the House budget, and Mark Hanley would tell Chris Christensen that he was going to cut my request by so much. It was still above my base. And I'd say to Chris, who was a friend of Mark Hanley, tell Mark I want to talk to him. So Mark would say, come on over. And I'd go in and I'd say, Mark, we could sit here and go through everything that I need and everything you don't want to give me for an hour and a half, or we could just split the baby. You give me half as much as you were gonna. He said, okay, we'll split the baby. And I'd walk out and we'd save 2 hours of our time. But then the big thing is that he had to defend it in the conference committee. And therefore, he had to be willing to trade the university or something like that for my budget. And he stood by his word. But I did that with Sackett on the Senate side. I remember Frank Ferguson was the subcommittee chair on my budget, and John told him he had to cut it by so much. And subcommittee chairs generally have to come in where the chairman of the finance committee tells them to come in. And Frank Ferguson refused to cut it. He said, I'm not going to cut his budget. He needs every dime, and I'm not going to cut it. And John said, well, it'll look bad because I'm his friend. And Ferguson said, I'm the subcommittee chair, not you. It's not going to look bad for you. So they didn't cut my budget. And one year the court told me to go create a court of appeals. And we discussed it, and I suggested that it would be a court of criminal appeals because there was no way I could get a full court of appeals and make them a cert court. And they concurred with this. And I was pretty good at my job in Juneau by then. And I put in a bill for a criminal court of appeals, and I ran it through the Senate in about a week and a half. And I ran it to the House, and I got caught in House Judiciary Committee. I forget who the chair was, but he wanted to study it for a year. And Sackett had a quiet talk with the Speaker of the House, and 2 days later, this representative stood on the House floor and said he decided not to hold it, and he was going to pass it out. So he passed it out, and it went to Rules. And the rules chairman decided he was going to not let it out till the next year. And the Speaker of the House had to go to Sackett. And by the way, the press asked Senator Sackett why this was such an important bill, why he needed so much. And Senator Sackett said, it was in the newspaper, I don't know why, Art said he had to have it. So, in any event, the rules chairman wouldn't let it out. And so the speaker came up and told John that he couldn't get it out. There's no way he could get it to the floor. And by the way, it had all the votes it needed on the floor. I had the votes, but he just, Sam Cotton decided he wasn't going to let it out that year. So within 24 hours, I've never seen power like this, at least in my history of watching the legislature. Senator Sackett killed every House priority and adjourned the legislature. And they went home for the year. And that was it. The first week of the next session, that bill came out and passed the House. But I'd never seen any power like that. That was very interesting. And, but most, you know, most of my time really was, we talk about the legislature because those are the big exciting moments when the Supreme Court rules that they've misspent $1 billion and, you know, and some crazy legislator says they're going to take it out of our budget. And I said, well, that's our next 200 years of our budget. but I mean, the Supreme Court always ruled during the year, as they should, when case was ready. So something would always pop up that would anger the legislature. And I always would just say to them, that just shows you they're not political. If they're political, do you think they would do that? So I found that I could work with the legislature. I understood their psyche. But my main job was to get this place running efficiently, from what I considered efficiently, and hiring good people. Getting courthouses built because we need them, getting more judges when we needed them. There was a decision, as you know, to ban plea bargaining, and the legislature had a lot of money, so it was very easy for me to get as many judges as I needed. And
that was Ab Gross's decision?
No, it wasn't Ab Gross's decision. There was a meeting at the 13 Coins, and I was there, and Ab was there, Brian Shortell was there, Jay Rabinowitz was there, I don't know who else was there. Maybe one or two others was there. Maybe head of public safety. And Ab and I started going back and forth. What would be interesting to do? You know, we've got all this money and so on and so forth. And we jointly came up with, why don't we ban plea bargaining? And Brian said, no, you can't do that. And I said, why not? The legislature will give us the money. They've got all kinds of money. And it would be a grand experiment. And of course, Ab took credit for it after that, but all of us were involved in that decision, and all tried to make it work, and it did work for a while. So, but yes, Ab did get most of the headline on that one. But the Supreme Court, a Superior Court judge, tried to enter a sentence bargaining or a plea bargaining, and Supreme Court told that judge by order he was not allowed to do it. So, I mean, the Supreme Court was enforcing this ban on plea bargaining, not just the Attorney General telling his people not to bargain.
Go ahead.
In any event, there were interesting times because the state had a lot of money. They were willing to experiment with things. I, at one time early on, I was of the opinion, I told the Supreme Court, that our court system would fail eventually. Because sooner or later we'd grow up to be like California or like New York and so on and so forth. And as far as I was concerned, I didn't see a lot of justice coming out of those states. They were just pushing cases through the mill. And I thought we needed a change. And the court listened to me and they said, all right, what would you like to do? And I said, what I'd like to do is ask LEAA for money to bring in a whole bunch of people, sociologists, attorneys, psychologists, all kinds of people, and design a new court system from scratch with the only boundaries that they would have would be the Alaska State Constitution. And the court agreed to that. And so I went and got resolutions from both houses of the legislature supporting that. And I got a letter from the governor supporting that. And LEA did not know what to do with this thing. So they sent a group of top people from around the country up here. I can't even name them all. One's on the Ninth Circuit now. Ed McConnell, who's the director of the National Center, Tom McKay. And they toured all around the state, and I set up meetings with them, with native groups, with police groups, with public defenders, prosecutors, attorneys. Everybody thought this was a great idea. And they wrote to LEAA and said, this is your last chance. This is the last chance you'll have to experiment in this country. And a state willing to do this, all three branches willing to do this, do it. And LEAA chickened out because Ted Kennedy wanted the same pot of money for something in Massachusetts, so they didn't do it. I thought that would have been a great experiment, but it never happened. Back, to, I guess, to the real world. Most of my job was laid out in the boundaries. I went to the court and asked them to change all the administrative rules. We're in it. Gave them, in the beginning, some more minute control over the administrative offices to say they had general supervisory powers over my office to give me more room to do things so I wouldn't have to bring everything upstairs. And they said that was fine. So we changed the administrative rules. We hired a rules attorney because they needed help in the rules area, which was my employee. As you know, we built a lot of buildings. We did training. The finances ran through us. We met with the trial court administrators at least quarterly, and we let them within limits set up their budget and gave them responsibilities for their budget so they felt that they had local control. So we met with the presiding judges. I met with the criminal justice working group, and I just thought the system was working the way a court system should work. I can't really sit here and go into every specific thing we did. It wasn't mostly because of me. I think the legislative work was, and as I told you, that was certainly a lot of luck in the beginning, but it was because I had very, very fine people working around me. I had a very supportive Supreme Court that wanted to do innovative things.
How did you establish your relationship with trial courts and the trial judges and keep in touch with that? And what was your basic mission in terms of ensuring just a high quality, continuous trial bench?
Well, I really didn't have a lot to do with that. The main mission of ensuring a high quality trial bench, as far as I'm concerned, was the Judicial Council's mission of making sure good names got to the governor. Jay Hammond was a good friend of me and of mine, and he often asked me about my opinions on some of those candidates. And what I would always tell him is that I don't care who you appoint governor, just make sure it's somebody who's going to work hard and who's bright, because we can't afford in this system to have somebody coming here to retire. And I think most of the governors did appoint hardworking men and women to sit on this bench. There were some exceptions, but for the most part, they weren't. The trial court wasn't always happy with the administrative office. They certainly weren't always happy with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court set up time standards that the trial court didn't like. I imposed leave rules. They had no leave rules when I got here. They could just work when they want and not work when they want. So I established that they got 30 days off a year and had the Supreme Court approve that.
What about judicial training?
I allowed judges to go out for judicial training I rotated them maybe every two or three years as funds would afford it, and then we had the annual judicial conference. And but I was as liberal as I could be. If a judge wanted to go somewhere and it was real training, we would come up with the money to send them to National College or someplace like that. I thought that was important, that they got out, and I thought it helped them, and I thought it helped the institution, because when they got out and talked to people about how this institution ran, as opposed to how institutions ran in the lower 48, they recognized how well it ran themselves, so they were happier. And people outside of here, Alaska got a great reputation as being one of the best run judiciaries in the country. So it was good for us, and it was good for the judges. We didn't provide that much internal training other than at the judicial conferences.
But it seemed to me you were a strong proponent of sending judges to the judicial college.
Oh, I was. As often as I could send them, I didn't. Those were the reasons that I put forth. Yes, if some judges didn't want training, and I felt that they needed it. The only real training fight I had. I had a real argument with the Supreme Court, and that was right after the Judicial Council come out and found disparity in sentences. And I felt it was imperative that we bring in experts and hold a basically sensitivity training. And the Supreme Court argued our judges are not racist, and that public defenders and district attorneys are deciding 95% of these cases through plea bargains, and there's where the most of the disparity is coming from. And I said, be it as it may, we have a public perception that there's disparity and that it's a judicial problem. We do have to have a conference. And the judges weren't happy because they thought that it made it look like that they were racist, that I had them go to sensitivity training, that I made them go to, and that I told the Supreme Court they had to do. And the Supreme Court was not happy about this, but they understood, you know, why. And we did it. We did do that program. And it was a good program, I thought. But that was the only training I forced on judges. I encouraged them to go out for training because we had training money that I could get, both federally and state money. And the state had a lot of dollars, and we had pretty decent budgets. So I encouraged them to go outside for training. But that was partly Machiavelli in them. I wanted them to realize how good they had it up here as opposed to judges outside. And I wanted them to realize that their caseloads were about a third of the size of most judges outside the state of Alaska. And at the same time, they got training and they got out and they appreciated the training. I wasn't always that popular with the trial court. I remember one judicial conference after the session came out, Judge Johnson stood up and pointed his finger at me and said, "You work for us." And I looked back at him and I said, "Read the Constitution. I work for the Supreme Court." There were those types of confrontations. There's no doubt about that. But for the most part, I got along individually well with the judges. They were mostly unhappy with the Supreme Court because no judge likes to get overturned on appeal. And it's just a natural thing. And administration was part of the Supreme Court. But we certainly, they weren't lacking for the most part for desks and things. It was a problem with computers at first because we tried to go centrally, and that was my fault. It was one of my greatest mistakes, I believe, of not immediately going with PCs in all the courtrooms and trying to design a central platform based on a Unix system. But you're still trying to design a computer system, so I don't take complete blame for that, but it was certainly one of my weak areas. Other than that, I was just myself. I was honest with everybody. I just like legislators. I didn't tell people what they wanted to hear. I treated them as equals, and I didn't speak up to any employee in this system, and I didn't speak down to any employee in this system. I just spoke to everybody just like I speak to you, or I would speak to Tamara, or, you know, this is what I am. But I was controversial, Alex. I wasn't always looked at as with sweetness and light, but I think everybody recognized that I did bring some good things to the institution.
It seems to me what you're describing is that you came in with some pretty firm ideas of how the institution should take shape as its own independent identity and as a separate branch of government, that you sort of stuck to your notions of what should happen, and that to a large extent you made it succeed. What I'm interested in is where did you get the principles and the views that you brought into the office, and where you got the kind of commitment to spend all those years making it all happen?
Well, I probably got the concept in constitutional law and law school, what the three branches of government were all about, and as a history major in college. That was just common sense. And what I believe when I came here is that the Supreme Court, because they were so young and there was so much to do, so many constitutional questions looming, they were neglecting what they were. They knew that they were separate, but that they neglected to look at it and say, Well, if we're separate, why are we giving the governor the budget and letting him cut it? Well, why are we letting the department, hiring people through the Department of Administration? Why are we letting people build buildings without even letting them look at it? They weren't concerned, that was minutia to them. But to me, it was the core of the institution. It was my job. I thought it was really important. And then after that, getting rid of those functions was a product of just being, I believe, ahead of the curve. I knew that I couldn't control them. I knew the legislature yelled every year we came in and asked for supplementals for conflict attorneys. I knew that I couldn't control recording. I knew none of them were central to the judicial function, in my view. So I found a way to get rid of them when the state had a lot of money and other people wanted power. I said, here, want power? You can have this. And they took it. Now, in later years, when the state didn't have the money, the governor, at least on two occasions, tried to give OPA back to us. They put it bills in front of the legislature to put it back in front of the judiciary. And I remember one time the head of Office of Management and Budget was in there testifying why we should do it and why we would be so much more efficient at it and so on and so forth. It was in the House Judiciary Committee, and I got up afterward and I said, I don't quite understand this. When we gave this agency, he created this agency through legislation, the executive branch didn't have any problem assuming it. And then, I have this study by an old director of the Office of Budget Management who and the analyzer who said it was much more efficient under the executive branch. Now, who was that? Oh, that was you. And that was the head of the OMB that was trying to get rid of it. So the legislature all just cracked up. That bill died. And we all went home. But, it was just fun. The little things like that. I was good at doing those kinds of things.
So who shaped your, once you got to Alaska and got involved at the head of the administrative part of the court system, who became your the closest figures you looked to in terms of the court system, the legislature, and the role that you had?
Well, Jay Rabinowitz was part father, brother, and son to me. I mean, he and I became very, very close, like family. He was mostly interested in the magistrate area. These other ideas that I had, that let's get rid of this and let's get rid of that, he saw, the wisdom in that, because I pointed out that they were uncontrollables and they were going to create problems for us all the way down. And I felt that judges appointing other attorneys to conflict cases could present appearance problems. So those kinds of things, they came out of my head. Because they didn't have to worry about them. I did. I'm the one that the legislature yelled at. I was the one that the people in accounting were saying, man, we're really going over budget. We're going to have to go ask for a supplemental on this. And so those were headaches that I wanted to get rid of. And I felt that they really did fit in with what I was telling the legislature, that they need a strong, independent judiciary, and that they should be judging the judiciary on its judicial function, not these ancillary things. So it fit in with the core mission as I saw it. But Jay Rabinowitz is no doubt, I don't think anybody would ever doubt that he was the closest thing to a father, brother, son that I ever had. And that doesn't mean that Jay and I always got along. We didn't. But most of our disagreements were professional. And one thing that I did in this system that I don't know if anybody in any other system could do is that if I disagreed with the Chief Justice on a policy issue of any magnitude, we brought it to the full court. And I would give my reasons for what I wanted to do and why, and then the Chief Justice would give his reasons, because we were only men on the court at that time, Dana hadn't come on the court yet, as to why he wanted to do it, and the court would vote, and I won some, and I lost some. And if I lost, I said okay, and I'd walk out the door, I'd never say another word about it, and I'd do exactly what they told me to do, because that's their job. And when I won, I felt good about it, and I walked out the door. But Jay never got upset, especially when he lost. Other justices, weren't quite as happy when the court followed my recommendation rather than theirs. I must admit that, especially toward the end of my career. That's the way it was. I thought that's the way it just should be. And I knew that the court liked me and respected me, and I liked and respected the court, and I think that helps. And I sort of presided over a whole changing of the court. In other words, new justices would come on, and I was here before them. And the same thing happened with the legislature. There came a time when I was there before any sitting legislator. When they came there, Art Snowden was an institution, so my job was a lot easier then. I had governors ask me to help them get some of their bills passed. It was just easier that way. In the executive branch, there were a number of influences. Av was very helpful because he was there for 8 years, but even more so, Governor Hammond. Governor Hammond led a delegation, the first state delegation, into China. He invited representatives from all three branches of government, and I was the one he invited to represent the judiciary. So he really liked me. But I think he was the best governor for the courts, because while I was trying to define the court and what the court was and what its mission was, he was the governor for those 8 years. By the time we had another governor, you know, the legislature had stopped complaining about getting the budgets automatically. I was much more well-known and well-liked in Juneau. I was a known quantity. So Jay Hammond was instrumental, and Av too, and this criminal justice working group, all of us working together. And we're all young people. I mean, as I said, Av was 36, Brian Shortell was 33, I was 33. And we're running these major institutions. The state was interesting that way. And other than that, different people that worked for me were, you know, had great influence on me. Bob Fisher, I had great respect for. Stephanie Cole, when I was in Juneau, this place couldn't have run because she was on the phone with me. She was doing the day-to-day stuff I would have to be doing. And she knew how I thought, and some of those things she wouldn't do, but she knew that I would do them, and she was good enough to do what she knew I would have done. I remember when I bought the old Times building, and the legislature just blew up, Stephanie said, "This is a bad idea. This is a terrible building." But my staff was all over town because the court had grown up and they'd taken all the space, basically. So I had people in rented space, and it was not a very efficient way to run a staff, to have to go to offices all over town to meet with them. Most of them were in Carl Gottstein, but I had other staff in other places. So I felt they kept raising our rent, and I felt that I had the authority to lease purchase a building. And I exercised that authority, and the legislature asked me not to sign that agreement till I met with them, and they were just going crazy. How dare you do this? So I had Bob prepare a financial and a benefit cost benefit analysis about buying a building at this amount of money versus renting space and projecting what rents would be over the next 20 years and the size of the office. And I asked the legislature to have their budget office do the same thing. And I went to a hearing in front of the legislature, and I told them why I did this and why I thought it was important, and in the long run it was going to save them a lot of money. They've got their own budget guy up there. He agreed with me 100%. He said he thought it was a great idea in the long run. And they said, okay, you can sign the documents now. And then they passed a bill saying that nobody could do any more lease purchases in the state after that building. But we did get that building. And I think Kit did, considering what that building looked like at the time, did a magnificent job in planning the renovation of that building. And our office was once again together, which made us much more efficient. And Stephanie came around after the building was completed and agreed that it was a great idea. The court was mixed on it. I think when I told them I was going to do it, I think they voted 3-2 to go with me. But after it was done, the court unanimously thought it was a great idea. So, I mean, you take your risks, and sometimes they pay off and sometimes they don't.
So that's one that paid off. By no happenstance, that building is now the Snowden Building.
Yes.
Named after you.
But it wasn't when it got built. It was when I retired.
Named after your retirement.
Yes.
And in your honor. So looking back on it, what do you think of the Alaska court system, your time here, and what it was when you came and what it is now?
I think I left it a better place than I found it. But if I didn't think that, I would have left years ago. I thought I did some good things. I thought I made a career choice that would never make me rich, but would allow me to do important things. And I feel the contributions I made were real contributions, and most of them, not all of them, have proved to be lasting contributions. Right now, there's a building across the state named after me that I think the Supreme Court should knock down some year and build a permanent Supreme Court building, which is another reason I bought that land, because I think the Supreme Court needs a building someday, and it should be a joint Supreme Court administrative building. They got a whole city block, but I think I planned for the future in there. I believe I left this state in good shape in both manpower and with facilities. Although Fairbanks had to wait so long, I made a commitment to them that I would get them a courthouse the minute Anchorage got its courthouse, because it needed more desperately. And it took a long time to get the Anchorage courthouse. There were a lot of wars over that, and some defeats in the process. Ultimately, we prevailed, but not to my satisfaction, because that building was full the day it was opened. I envisioned a building that would have some growing space when we first started in the planning for that. I don't know what else to say. I don't think we have the same strong relationship with the executive branch that we had when I was here. But I think that's as much to do with the executive branch as it is with the judiciary. I used to be able to go in and talk to the governor whenever I wanted to on any issue. I could talk to any commissioner at any time. I'm told they're much more insular now, and I think that's bad. I think it's bad for the state. I think it's bad for the justice system. I think it's bad for this institution. I think that from what I can see is certainly the administrative office is being competently run. That we seem to have enough judges, that the Supreme Court's doing a good job. And that will continue, for the most part, to be as long as some type of relationship is maintained, at least with the governor, if not with the executive branch. I think we're on solid footing with the legislative branch. But when I left my job, basically, I told the court that we were going to have to split my job, that no longer did I think the way the institution had grown that one person could both be administrative director and handle the legislative function. I thought that would be very difficult because of the complexity of this organization. So I suggested that I had trained a replacement for Juno, I painstakingly trained that replacement so that I wouldn't leave the court in bad shape, and I thought I had trained a good administrator to do the other side, and the court followed my recommendations and did that. Now, when Stephanie leaves, she's going to have to make sure that Chris Christensen has trained a successor, because if you do not have a successor that gets along with the legislature, somebody has to walk down there like I did back in 1973. I think it's going to be very difficult. So I think that's an area the court should certainly keep an eye on.
And before we wrap up, maybe tell us what you've been doing since you left the court system, and whether you've stayed active in court system administration, in your interests in in court systems?
Well, immediately after I retired, I left the state. I felt that it would be much easier for my successors to do their job if I wasn't. I was an elephant in the room. Anybody that's been in this job for 25 years, nobody before me lasted 5 years. The legislature, as you know, wrote the administrative director in a controversial bill under the judicial retirement, put a 10-year vest on it, and that was meant to keep continuity in this position. So when I retired, I was asked if I would co-chair a justice commission in Alaska with the attorney general, because the attorney general wasn't getting along well with the legislature at the time, and they weren't appointing members, and the judiciary didn't want to appoint any members for some reason. I don't think Stephanie looked at it as something that was in the judiciary's interest at that time. But when I agreed to co-chair it, it was no longer deemed as threatening to the judiciary, and Justice Masters agreed to appoint members, and the legislature appointed members. So I co-chaired that commission for 3 years, and I had some health problems here and there. I travel. I've been called on to take part in panels at the national judiciary meetings, like on the 50th year anniversary of the founding of CASCA. Ed McConnell and I and one other person were asked to speak. I have been given a number of awards. You were present when I was inducted by Chief Justice Rehnquist into the Warren E. Burger Society. While I was still court administrator, Warren Burger gave me his Distinguished Service Award personally at a Chief Justice's conference. And then he died, by the way, after he did that. And then after Justice Rehnquist inducted me into the Rehnquist Society, he died. So I don't think I'm going to be getting any more awards. Yes, I think they have. But other than that, not that very much. I've gone down a couple of places to help out state directors or on minor projects. I want to start to get more active again. That's why I agreed to take part in this project, because I don't want to get bored. I appreciate the opportunity to take part in not today's part of the project, certainly, but the rest of it, because I got to see friends and I got to talk to contemporaries, and it was fun.
Thank you, Art.
Thank you. So did you learn anything, Tamara?
Yes. I know how to stay out
good
of your
story.
Way.
Good story.
I was a really nice guy. A lot of people liked me.
Awesome. I know. I think he's great. I didn't realize that you had been with the court system as long as you had. Because I came in 94.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost 25 years. Boy.
That's a long sit in hard chairs. But I tell you, it would have been harder than some chairs. Those are pretty comfortable chairs.
Oh, the hour. The break on the hour helps.
Yeah.
Are they okay to see?
Yeah, they are okay.
For an hour.
I have a hard time in a much harder time in soft chairs than them.
We kind of debated. These seem pretty comfortable, yeah. But they look so stark when you, compared to the. I'm sorry, I had to break away and put that.
No, up. That was good.
The sun was coming, yeah. And your face was getting lighter and lighter. Yeah. I thought he's going to be all white if I don't.
No, that worked
out
fine.
There. Okay, we need to. Maybe I'll extend the black. Oh no, what's that? I'll extend the black. I didn't realize that we missed that spot. Yeah, and I thought about bringing up. We've got a portable.
Sort of the first day that we've had a real
Yeah, we didn't have any problems before this. Last week, about this time, we came in and realized we needed to block out that, but we didn't realize it went that far down. Well, just in the afternoons, the sun's coming around, and it was just reflecting off the wall there, so.
I'm sure you got a good product.
It's over there.
Here's your other little souvenir.
I think he's already seen these all week.
Gee, where do you get that?
Where do you have that?
Old one.
This is the old, I know there are other old ones, this one.
I've got some.
You got copies of these, I think.
Yeah, that's Jay, from Jay's brother down there.
Yeah.
Down at, a little bit of the north.
Fort Town.
Yeah.